Hello, and welcome to The Stishy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. I'm Derek Healy, your host. Joining me this week from Aberdeen is politics reporter Adele Merson, our producer Chris Finn, and making his Stishy debut, the Prescient Journal's brand new political editor, Andy Phillip. Now, it's been another extremely busy week in Scottish politics, and there's a lot to discuss. One of the biggest talking points has been the Scottish Government's controversial hate crime legislation, which MSPs have voted in favour of, despite concerns about freedom of speech. We had a mammoth five-hour debate on the subject on Wednesday, and then finally on Thursday, we had the vote. Adele, you've been covering this quite closely. It's a detailed subject, and it's one that sparked a lot of debate. Can you talk us through what happened this week?
The bill reached its third stage this week, which is, they were finalising the last amendments to the bill. And yeah, as you say, it started on, I've lost track of the days, Wednesday. There was a debate in Parliament that lasted 5 hours, and this was going through the amendments. There were just so many amendments and so much debate that they had to actually, it went on to, I think it was one of the latest sittings of the Scottish Parliament, or one of the longest ones anyway. And it got to the point at 9 o'clock where the lights actually went out, which was apparently due to sort of, energy saving measures that the Scottish Parliament has. So they had to delay into the next day. So yesterday, as you say, it was agreed 82 votes to 32, but it has really, I've been following it since April when it was first introduced to Holyrood, and it's been, many people have said, one of the most controversial pieces of legislation in the sort of history of devolution. It got 2,000 submissions at the first stage from people that were, the main concerns are really around that balance between protecting victims of hate crime and the impact that the potential chilling impact on freedom of speech. So that centres mainly around the stirring up hatred offences, which would criminalise people who stir up hatred on the grounds of religion, sexual orientation, age, disability and transgender identity. So, the Justice Secretary, he made a point that there's a high sort of criminal threshold to commit an offence. It will only be if someone has been threatening or abusive and intended to stir up hatred against a protected group. So he kind of argued that, if you hold controversial, offensive views, that's not the sort of thing that would be criminalised unless you were, with intent, trying to stir up hatred against a particular group. But obviously, opponents on the other side, they feel that, a lot of the terms were too vague, that there was a real potential impact on freedom of speech.
Yeah, I mean, it's been such a controversial subject, and we've seen the Society of Editors come out with concerns about whether newspaper columnists would be free to share their views under this legislation, and we've also heard discussions over whether it could stifle debate over things like gender identity and trans rights. I know the government's made a number of concessions over this bill already, but would it be fair to say even now there's still a lot of concerns at this stage? What was being said by opposition parties?
Yeah, one of the main bones of contention yesterday was there's certain MSPs, Joanne Lamont was sort of leading the charge, I guess, on this topic of the fact that sex, now this is really technical stuff, so I'll try my best to explain this, but basically sex as a protected characteristic wasn't included in the bill. Instead, the Scottish Government has opted to set up a working group, which will be led by Baroness Helena Kennedy QC, and it will look in some depth, well, real depth, with a bunch of sort of gender experts into whether there should be a standalone offence of misogynistic hate crime. So that means that currently the bill does not provide any protection for women. Now, Ms. Lamont was making the argument that, you just have to see the events of this week, how many women are victims of, gender-based hate crime, harassment, violence, and that she really, there was really quite strong debate in this area that women, how can you bring forward, a hate crime bill that doesn't include protection for women? But obviously the kind of counter argument to that was it's an area where there's differing opinions. So a lot of the women's rights groups were actually in support of holding off and having this misogynistic working group, because they say that misogynistic hate crime is really complex, it needs looked at in more sort of depth, and that just adding sex as a characteristic wouldn't sort of fill in some of the gaps that are in the law. So that is one of the major areas. Another one would be the area of sort of gender identity, where some opponents of the bill were making the point that it is a very, it's a very live debate in Scottish politics at the moment. And so they make the point that, you know, one of the interesting parts of yesterday was that Elaine Smith, the Labour MSP, said that in actually debating the bill, she had been accused online of hate speech. So she's making the argument that even debating these issues, you will be accused of hate speech, and that they have concerns around people being criminalised for holding opinions on a political issue that is still very much a live issue with differing viewpoints. So that is sort of where a lot of the main criticisms lie.
It seems like a really kind of complex piece of legislation with a lot of different elements at play going on all at the same time. I know one of the elements here is a sort of change that would mean that effectively you'd have to prove a sort of intent to stir up hatred. Could you talk us through that a little bit? I mean, I think that's going to be, on the face of it, sounds like it'd be quite difficult to prove that in court.
That was one of the major concessions that the Justice Secretary made way before stage three. He made that several months ago. The original bill didn't include intent, and that was seen as quite a negative thing by free speech complainers. And so off the back of the kind of outcry, the Justice Secretary said that put into the bill that it would have to be intent only. I mean, yeah, as you say, I don't know. I'm not a criminal, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an expert in these kind of areas, but it seems, yeah, you would have to prove that somebody intended to stir up hatred. I don't know how you counter people that might say, well, I didn't intend to stir up hatred and plead sort of innocence in that area. I think that's going to be, you know, former deputy SNP leader Jim Sillars, he put out very strong comments. He's been a vocal opponent of this bill. He put out very strong comments last night, sort of saying that he really thinks that this bill will only really be tested once it becomes an act. It will only really be tested under the sort of forensic scope of a court, where he could see sort of this is where a lot of these issues will come to play.
As you say, this is one of the concessions being made by the Justice Secretary for that change. I was interested to see a tweet shared by the First Minister earlier this week. It was on a totally unrelated subject, but looking underneath, there was just response after response from people furious about this legislation and really saying that the women in particular had been let down by this. It seemed at times as if the government is really prepared to sort of get this over the line, no matter the political cost. I'm interested, we've got an election coming up in May. How much political capital do you think the SNP have lost in getting this over the line?
I find it hard to, as you say, you're totally correct. There was a lot of discussion on Twitter. There was various hashtags directed at a lot of like women and feminist groups who were concerned about the bill, and in large numbers feeling very, being very critical of it. I think that in terms of political capital, I mean, it's anyone's guess really how much of an impact it's going to have. I would say that it's just such a crowded field at the moment in terms of there's coronavirus every single day. There's the Alex Salmond inquiry. And I think up until this week, I don't think as much attention was being paid to the hate crime bill as might have been in a sort of, if you want to call it, a normal year. So I don't really know, similar to the Salmon inquiry, I don't really know how much it will cut through with voters. But, you know, freedom of speech is something that I think everybody holds dear. And so in that regard, it could potentially prove pretty controversial with a lot of different people.
We're going to get to the kind of fortunes of the SNP and different parties at Horrid in a bit more detail a little bit later on. But we have the Scottish Conservative Party conference this weekend. We know already that we're going to be hearing from Douglas Ross, Ruth Davidson and Boris Johnson. Andy, you've been having a little look at this. What do you think we can expect from the conference this weekend?
Well, like all political party conferences, a lot of it is just preaching to the converted. And I think you'll see a lot of just route one politics from Boris Johnson and Ruth Davidson and Douglas Ross, who just want to remind their base that they are the most unionist party out there, and they're the ones that need a bit of a geeing up in to take the fight to the SNP. I think there'll be some policies, obviously, because there's an election on the horizon. We'll be learning a lot more about that as the weekend goes. We hear things about conservative hobby horses. There'll be a lot of policing, law and order. There'll be more on the hate crime. There'll be things about whether the SNP can be trusted. There's a lot of trust issues going around at the moment. But when it all comes down to it, and this touches on the hate crime stuff, you can't go anywhere in Scotland or talk about any politics in Scotland without it always coming back to where do you stand on the Constitution. And when in the pecking order of things, even in a pandemic year, each political party can't get away from that. Even Labour, who are doing their damnedest to try and not talk about it at all, have ended up having to get rid of a candidate over perception of where she stands on potentially even letting a referendum happen. So yeah, when it all comes down to it, that's where the headlines will be as usual, I think.
Do you think there'll be any attempt, given it's, you know, new party leader, a very important election coming up, do you think there'll be any attempt to look at anything else and try and have some big idea or policies, or is it just going to be independence? Is that going to really what we see coming out of this?
No, I mean, there will still be policies to be outlined. There will still be everyday spending and issues such as health, local accountability, infrastructure. I mean, these are all things that have been shunted to the side, even more than normal. But when you think about what this year's really been about, which is a pandemic, the health service has been under strain like never before, social care, all of these things. And they're all issues which the Conservative Party have been raising with the SNP week in, week out. So, you know, there's going to be a big focus on that. We will hear more about things like how police have coped with the additional strain, how local hospitals have coped, and elderly residents all over the country, particularly shielding groups and people in care homes, social care. These are all issues which people still care about and will want to know how to differentiate each party. Look at education, for example. John Swinney, who's been up to his neck in trouble in the past week or so, he's got an education report that might not come out until after the election. The Conservatives are furious about that. The Liberal Democrats think they could even get him on another vote of no confidence. Voters will want to know, as the closer they get to the voting booth, that's what they're going to want to talk about.
We know already that Boris Johnson's going to use the conference to underline his opposition to granting a second referendum, even if the SNP wins a pro-independence majority in May. The Telegraph is reporting that it's part of a strategy to get out ahead of the election result and possible SNP majority, to be proactive about the messaging behind saying no to a new referendum. But at the same time, Scottish Conservatives will presumably be going into the election saying a vote for the SNP is a vote that would put the union at risk. So is there a risk here that by coming out with this so early, that it could actually be a bit of a gift for the SNP during the campaign, that they're going to be able to argue that point?
Yeah, the SNP are already on that avenue right now, trying to say, well, they don't know what they're saying. They're mixing their messages, and Douglas Ross is the one that's going to have to explain what he stands for. Because if he wants to make it all about referendums, then the SNP don't really have to say anything about it, because, as they say, they're the ones that keep raising it. But if the threat is that the SNP will force a referendum on an unwilling public if they get a majority, which is what the Scottish Conservative pitch is at the moment, then Boris Johnson coming up and saying absolutely never, no matter what happens, it spikes that whole argument.
Of course, all of this kind of comes against the backdrop of support for independence appearing to fall away a little bit, according to two new polls. It's a bit of a turnaround from where we were a few months ago, with poll after poll showing majority support for independence when don't knows are excluded. We know, of course, that polls are just polls, and there's a long time to go before May, and certainly before any new referendum. But Andy, how concerned should independence supporters and the SNP be by these polls?
Well, yeah, there was rather enthusiastic claims that this was now the settled will of the people, when among the more excitable fringes of independence supporters. But obviously, any setback is going to make them think, well, have we blown it? But when you've got the polls slipping, and Boris Johnson saying no, and the constant battle within the SNP to see, well, have we got a plan B? Then that, if the feeling is that they're stuck with nowhere to go, then that's when they start to think, well, what are we fighting for here? And that's why they seem to be turning on each other a lot on certain issues at the moment, not helped by the Nicola Sturgeon, Alex Salmond inquiry into the harassment scandal at Holyrood. So I think there's still a lot to be said for the fact that the polls are on a knife edge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there isn't a referendum on the table, and people won't really, really think about how they're going to vote until that were to be the case. But also, we keep forgetting about all the people who say they don't know. A lot of the polls are reported as a who said yes, who said no. But there's a sizable chunk who don't know. And they're the people, say 1 in 10, according to YouGov in the last couple of days, that this hinges on. And it might be that the anger, the backlash at Brexit pushed them towards yes, and they're maybe melting away a little bit now, or perhaps being put off by something else that's going on within the SNP. I don't know. But they're the ones that are the key here. So if 1 in 10 people have no idea, and I guess polling experts tend to suggest that they naturally fall back to the status quo, then yeah, the yes campaign still has a lot of work to do to reach out to those people if they've got any chance of a sustained large majority, which we haven't really seen yet.
It's such an interesting time, because obviously, as you touched on, we had John Swinney survive his second vote of no confidence this week. And questions are still hanging over Nicola Sturgeon relating to the Alex Salmond inquiry. Opposition parties during that no confidence vote were very keen to stress that it's the whole government they have concerns around, not just Mr. Swinney. Adele, do you think we're starting to see this kind of Salmond affair finally cut through to voters, or is there something else at play here?
Yeah, certainly. I don't think the Salmond affair will have done the SNP any favours just before the election, but I personally don't know if it's the main reason behind recent polling. I think that if you look back to sort of last year, the height of the pandemic, as it were, Nicola Sturgeon was getting a lot of, even more praise for her sort of communication skills and for Scotland's handling of the pandemic. And so I think you got a lot of people that wouldn't necessarily have always voted, that they maybe have never been SNP voters, they've never been independence voters, thinking, you know, using that stark contrast of looking at Nicola Sturgeon versus Boris Johnson. I think at that point, you know, coronavirus was just more of a sort of, I'm not saying it's gone away, but it was more of a focus on public health messages, I guess, rather than the politics of it all. I think now we're getting very, very close to an election. Things are obviously becoming more political. I think you probably got a proportion of people who potentially now have a divergent view in terms of the route out of lockdown. Maybe they disagree with the current path, some people, and think it's too cautious. So I think you've maybe just got more of a divergence of opinion than you did sort of if you're talking April, May of last year. Now people have had longer getting used to the pandemic, and they've maybe started to disagree with certain aspects of the government's handling of it. And I think that has been potentially quite a factor in the figures.
Just on that polling point as well, I think it's interesting. People forget that we're talking about an election which is for a party that's been in government since 2007, trying to get back into power again. And the conversation is sort of hinging on whether or not that party might even still be able to get a majority. I mean, that's pretty astounding, just, you know, for its own sake, in a parliament that was designed really not to have a one party that would dominate over all others. So the fact that they're being picked apart quite forensically for, oh, is this the end for the SNP? Is this the end for Nicola Sturgeon and stuff? If you look at where we actually are, all those years after they were first elected into government, it is pretty amazing. And they've still got twice as much support, according to the recent polls, as the next party, the main opposition party, basically. So it's tempting to look at a couple of points being knocked off here and there as a signal of something big happening. But I mean, the actual landscape of Scottish politics at the moment is still weighted very heavily in favour of Nicola Sturgeon, even if she doesn't get a majority.
It's interesting. I know from conversations I've had with individuals from kind of opposition parties, certainly the Salmond affair is one thing that's being mentioned, but there is a sort of feeling that there is something wider there. There is maybe a bit of a shine coming off in terms of the handling of the pandemic. There's a delay for vaccines, that's slowed down quite a lot in recent weeks. So there possibly are kind of wider issues there. We had polling expert John Curtis on this podcast a few months ago, and he told us that Brexit had really pushed a lot of voters to independence. I was wondering, with the Brexit deal being done, there's obviously still problems there, but do you think we're possibly seeing some of those voters who felt very strongly about leaving the EU start to return to the middle ground, maybe entering back into that don't know section? Andy, I'll maybe come to you on that first.
Yeah, I would say definitely. There was a lot of, to be crude, I suppose, a middle class backlash, which Brexit really just threw a firecracker into. And they went looking for the alternative. And, as time goes by, they look at everything and the issues that perhaps are important to that demographic are schools, healthcare, and all the rest of it. And despite what I said earlier about how incredibly high the SNP are polling now, there is still the danger that goes with that, that they look at then all these domestic problems and think, well, they've been looking after this for so long, maybe it is time for someone else to have a look. In fact, if you think back, we're talking about this the other day, polling in 2011, just before the election where Labour were ahead, they were on course to win after the SNP's first spell in government, and their polls just melted. This completely collapsed from roughly now in the run-up to May. That won't happen to the SNP, but it shows you how the closer you get to the polls, minds start to focus, everything starts to sharpen up a little bit. I mean, Labour conspired somehow to give the SNP a majority at that election, which was a shocking state if you look at the polls from a couple of months before. So yeah, it's volatile, even though, as I pointed out, that the SNP are so far ahead. You know, once the shine comes off, it's very hard, it would seem, in Scotland to get back. The pendulum seems to swing one way then the other.
And what do you think on this? I mean, we've got a new Scottish Labour leader, we've got a new leader of the Conservatives as well. I mean, is there a potential for a bit of momentum to build, do you think, or where do you think we stand on this?
Well, I was just about to say the opposite, actually, just in terms of, although, you know, there's been a lot of discussion there on the shine coming off and things, I think we still have to look at it in the context of Nicola Sturgeon as a leader versus she's up against a brand new Scottish Labour leader who I imagine won't have had the chance to massively cut through with the public yet, and with a leader in the Scottish Conservatives who, you know, although is relatively well known, he's not even in the Scottish Parliament yet. So if we look at it in that wider context, you know, Nicola Sturgeon appears on the TV most days and people, I think, have an appreciation for what she's done throughout the pandemic in terms of the sort of communication of public health messages and her presence.
I think it's going to be an extremely interesting election, and whatever happens in May and further afield, I'm sure we'll be keeping a very close eye over proceedings. But that's all from this issue this week. Thanks to Adele Merson, Andy Phillip, and our producer Chris Finn. Don't forget to listen, download or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and join us again next week to be better briefed. Bye for now.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshy from DC Thompson Media.